all know money can't buy happiness, but it sure can help. Well, what other measure do we have, really? I mean, seriously. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. We could certainly argue about whether increasing employment in clean energy is really enough to sustain our economy. At some point, you would think growth would have to suffer. Or does it? The toll-free phone number here, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. Email talk@aprn.org. New ways to measure sustainable growth of the topic on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
NOAA Fisheries Service requires sport charter halibut fishing operators to apply between February 4th and April 5th of this year for next year's permit in southeast and south central Alaska. Apply during this period or you won't receive a permit even if you qualify otherwise. Information online at alaskafisheries.noaa.gov or call 1-800-304-4846, press option number 2. This message sponsored by NOAA Fisheries Service.
I mean, it's just common sense, isn't it? The economy has to suffer if you are consuming less energy, right? I mean, at least that's what we're hearing. We're going to be talking about that today, about what is real economic growth, what is sustainable, and what is sustainable economic growth. Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK, anywhere in the state of Alaska, toll-free. If you're calling from Anchorage, it's a local call at 550-8422. Email is talk@aprn.org. Now, it could be that you are one of those people who believes that elite scientists are feathering their own nests by stirring up panic with regards to the climate being changed by human activity, and that there's nothing to all that. And if so, let's just say that that's the real situation, and we're talking about a hypothetical situation on today's program, all right? Because I don't want to argue about that. My first guest is Tim Jackson. He's from the University of Surrey. He is a commissioner for the Sustainable Development Commission of the United Kingdom. Welcome to the show, Tim Jackson.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So you have written a book, Prosperity Without Growth, Economics for a Finite Planet, and I assume this is available in the U.S. as well.
It is now, yeah. It's as from early January. It's distributed by a U.S. distributor as well.
So tell me, I don't think we have anything in the U.S. Such as a Sustainable Development Commission. So what is it?
No, there is a story there, actually. Yeah, there has been quite a lot of talk about setting up such a commission, but it hasn't happened yet in about, over a decade of talking.
Went ahead and did it? What?
Yeah, the Sustainable Development Commission was set up on the back of the Rio Conference on Environment and Development in 1992, and in the UK, what it does is it advises the government on sustainable development, which means that we say things and sometimes they listen.
Well, what are you saying? Have you found some other way to measure sustainable economic growth other than the gross domestic product?
Well, what we're saying really to start with is that the gross domestic product, the total value of our goods and services measured one way, or indeed the total incomes that we derive from those measured another way, that's been a useful thing over about 50 years to get a handle on the economy and how the economy is structured, but it's left out a whole bunch of stuff that actually we know is quite important, like whether we're running down our natural assets, whether we're degrading our environments, actually even whether we're running down our financial assets is all missed by the GDP, the gross domestic product. And so it's a measure with some quite serious limitations, because it's not telling us that much about the future. It's not really giving us an indication of how sustainable our economic activity is. And if all we're doing all the time is growing the GDP bigger and bigger, and we're doing it by plundering the Earth's resources, there has to be a point, and this is the key message from Prosperity Without Growth, there has to be a point at which things go pear-shaped for us. You know, we run out of the basic stuff that keeps the economy going. So that's the first, you know, kind of hard lesson. It's not a particularly new one. It's one that's been around in the debates about growth and sustainability for a good few decades. But actually, it's one that we've had some pretty sharp and painful reminders recently of its reality, that, you know, when commodity prices go up, when fuel prices go up, when food prices go up, bad things can happen in the economy. And so it's worthwhile, at least in our view, putting a little bit of thought into how serious those limits are, what we can do when we're faced with them, and whether we should be measuring slightly different things than just a very simple measure of economic activity.
Yeah, when I started researching this, I got going on this this talk show line, when some of the guests I would have on about renewable energy would say, well, you know, they are coming up with new ways of measuring economic growth that aren't just gross domestic product. And I was quickly led to the work of Herman Daly, who was the senior economist at the World Bank and now is kind of, sort of turned on his profession. I think one of the problems, at least in the United States, is that economics has always been about markets. It's been about markets for so long that really they're not comfortable talking about anything else. And the way that Daly put it was, and I think this is very apt to what you were just saying, that they're talking about the circulatory system, but they don't get down to the digestive system. Where does stuff come from? Where does stuff really go? That's kind of what it's about.
That's absolutely right. I mean, economics actually in the early days was a lot better at taking account a little bit of that, digestive system, what comes in and what goes out. But in its more recent incarnation, economics almost is ecologically illiterate in some ways. It just doesn't take an adequate account of the resources that are being used to make the system run. It assumes that we can be infinitely clever, if you like. Even when we run out of one thing, we'll find another thing to replace it, and we can keep the whole system going by being very clever and having newer and more exciting and more efficient technologies, and we don't have to worry too much about the impact of that. And that's a view, I think, that although outside the economics profession, it's pretty well recognized now that there are those kinds of limits, and we need to take them seriously. Within economics itself, we still don't quite have an economics that understands that, that brings those things in and says, look, natural resources, natural assets matter. The wastes that are going into the environment matter. They actually have economic costs that will come back and bite us.
You know, it's kind of reminding me of those monks that used to debate how many angels could dance on the point of a pin. In other words, maybe this has become almost a religion. The science of economics has become a religion. I mean, certainly, they've been giving out until the last one. Most of the Nobel Prizes have been given out to people who really did nothing but justify more. I mean, they were barracudas, essentially. They were talking more and more about selfishness and self-interest and the invisible hand and all that ad nauseum.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. There is a sort of religious aspect to it, and it's one of the things that you come across when you try to say anything a little bit different. And interestingly, even something as basic as, hang on a minute, we live on a finite planet. How can we keep growing and growing and growing? Our economy, by the end of this century, even if we go more or less as we are, is going to be 80 times bigger than the one that, certainly when I was born in the world, in somewhere in the middle of last century, than the economy was then. How do we get an economy that is 80 times bigger within a finite planet? And then, even then, it's not a very equal place. By that stage, you've got 9 billion people maybe living on the planet. And if you want them all to have the lifestyle that we have, your economy has to be 200 times bigger than it was when I was born. And so, and it's almost like, almost inconceivable, really, in a way. It is still the same planet. As far as I know, last time we looked, you know, it hasn't got itself 200 times bigger. It's still the same size as it was. So how is the economy going to get that big? And yet, actually, even asking that basic question is out of bounds. There is a sort of semi-religious, as you say, a sort of a visceral reaction to questioning the system, the economic system that we have.
Well, how do economists now? So let's say those are the conservative economists. Now we go to the, let's say, progressive economists, such as yourself. Well, how do we start quantifying some of these other things? How do we get whole cost involved? How do we quantify some of these things that are provided by the environment? And, if they go away, it seems to me that, in other words, that often these costs only show up as opportunity cost. And that's a lot of guesswork. Opportunity cost means that it's something you didn't do. And then you have to say, well, because I didn't take advantage of that opportunity, I lost out on X dollars.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of ways to approach this. One is to say that it isn't just about the opportunity cost of not doing something. It's also opportunity cost of doing something. If by doing all that economic activity, you're destroying forests, running down your oil supplies, degrading your rivers, making your soils less productive, those are all severe opportunity costs for the future. We just won't have the basis for civilized society in a future which doesn't have those things. And one of the first things you can do is actually just to say, well, how much do I really know about those critical resources? What do I know about the state of existing soils? What do I know about the value of those ecosystem services? And you start to quantify those things. You start to actually, in some cases, it's a very, very basic, almost bean counting exercise. What are the number of hectares of particular kinds of forest or particular kinds of habitats? What's the quality of the soils that could be used for food production? How has it changed over time? And just actually bringing those things in and saying these are real physical limits to what we can do in the future is one of the starting places. And then another is actually to say, well, maybe if I know how much physical stuff I need in order to produce any given output of dollars of economic growth, then maybe I can put a value on that physical stuff, and maybe I should be counting that value in the calculations I make. So there's now a lot of work along those lines, and some of it is saying, hang on a minute, we're using stuff too fast. We're not going to be able to sustain that. Some of it is saying this stuff has a value, it has an economic value, and you'd be quite surprised at the results of that exercise, because they mostly show, and your next guest has done some of this work himself, they mostly show that the value of those services is about the same order of magnitude as the value of economic global flows. In other words, it's huge. We rely very, very heavily on those services to keep our economies going. If we don't measure it, if we don't account for it, if we don't bring it into our decisions, then we're making bad decisions.
Our guest is Tim Jackson. He's the author of Prosperity Without Growth. He's speaking to us from Surrey in the United Kingdom. And we'll turn now to somebody in Alaska. I think the first bill the legislature in this year's session has passed was allowing traffic laws to take account for what they call low-speed electric vehicles. And this was pushed basically by people who want low-speed electric vehicles, and we're going to talk to a dealer of one of those right now, Jerry Herbrinson in Petersburg. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
How are you doing, Jerry?
Doing great.
So can you tell me, what did this new law do that wasn't on the books before?
The low-speed vehicles previously were allowed to be driven on any highways posted, and still are, any highway posted at 35 miles an hour or less. What the bill does in most communities, except for Anchorage and Fairbanks, it allows the vehicles to be driven on any highway posted at 45 or less, provided the local community adopts it.
Now, Jerry, you're selling these cars, right?
Yes.
Did anybody actually buy one yet?
Only 13.
Really? You've got 13 of these things running around in Petersburg?
Yes.
Well, what are they like? What do they look like? I'm picturing a golf cart.
Negative. These are actually small hatchbacks. They're four-door, and then the back door opens up sideways. They accommodate adults very nicely, four adults easily. They're quite spacious. I'm over 6 foot six, and I have more body space in these vehicles than I do my full-size Chevy.
Okay, now you got to recharge these, and I want to get down to that, but also, have you noticed your electric bill went up?
Actually, not very much. It's amazingly, you're only burning about 2 cents a mile. So in these small towns, you're not putting on that many miles.
Yeah. Well, I was talking to Chris Rose of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project yesterday over at the Agriculture Department Jobs Forum, and he made the amazing prediction that it won't be very long before some Alaska community that has abundant hydro and high fuel costs because the fuel has to be barged in or whatnot, that they're going to go all electric vehicle. He says it just has to happen. The money, it's all in the dollars and cents, right down to the marketplace calculation.
Not only is that inevitable, but I think that would be a prime opportunity for the car manufacturer to find a controlled environment for them to do testing.
Do you feel that you have the ultimate engineered electric vehicle, or do you feel that we're just at the beginning of this? I mean, we all know about the conspiracy theory that there was a very superior vehicle, and people are kind of trying to get back to that, a superior vehicle that was killed off by the auto industry.
I think that there may be some validity to that. We're at the ground floor. Back then, the large auto industry produced the electric car. Right now, it's more of the smaller companies who are trying to get a wedge, and so that they're having a harder time. So the product I would call the product an entry level. It definitely is not top.
And what do you pedal? What is your line? Your vehicle?
These are Miles electric vehicle, Miles EV.
And what's the cost for one of these little puppies?
They're about $14,000 to $16,000.
Well, that's not too bad. And you have a website here. I guess I'll put that up. It's www.solarwindofalaska.com. And what was involved in becoming a dealer for this? Just getting in touch with the vendor?
Yes. Actually, I saw some information on the Zen, which is a competitor vehicle. And then after some research on the Zen, I discovered the Miles. And so I bought a vehicle for myself, and based upon that, I bought into a number of vehicles for inventory.
So how does it
jumped in?
Yeah, but Jerry, I really appreciate you making time for us. How do you run these things? In other words, how long a run can you make? Is there some kind of reliable, like if I'm driving a gas powered vehicle, I know when I'm running out. Do you have the equivalent of that, and how many miles can you do between charges?
Basically, the range is between 25 and 35 miles. And rather than a gas gauge, you're basically working off of a voltage meter. But the other thing easier to do is just have a tripometer, and every morning when you unplug it, you push the tripometer and you just watch your mileage. In these smaller communities, by the time you get 25, 35 miles in a day, that's pushing the limit. I mean, who's going to drive that off and around to the post office?
So have you had it occur where you've been somewhere and running low and you just knock on somebody's door and says, hey, do you mind if I plug in for a while? Here's $10.
Do I have to answer?
Not really.
Actually, if a full charge at 2 cents, you're talking about 50 cents. So if you're plugged in for an hour, they don't even know you're there. It's just a couple cents.
So how long do they have to sit and recharge?
It takes about 10 minutes to 15 minutes per mile. So if you're fully discharged, it'll charge in 6 to 8 hours.
So you do have to do a little more planning when you own one of these things. That's pretty clear.
If you're going the long distance, most of the individuals have a cycle, you know, they go to the post office, they go to the grocery store, and then they check downtown. So they're running about 15 miles a day, and that's just what they do, and it's just in the background. They don't even realize they're running an electric vehicle anymore.
So when do you have to replace your power unit, your battery or whatever?
I haven't been there. Don't know. Huh. The manufacturer claims 15 to 20, possibly 25,000 miles. So, you know, you're looking at 5 to 7 years.
Wow. That's great. I want to go back here to our other guest in the United Kingdom, Tim Jackson in Surrey. Are you seeing any of these little electric cars buzzing around there?
Yeah, we do. There's a little tiny two-seater vehicle that is actually quite popular in London at the moment. So it doesn't have a huge range, but it's fantastic very easy to park, certainly, and pretty nippy around the streets of London. So that's been quite popular, and one or two, you know, slightly more exciting initiatives, and then the hybrid vehicles, of course, which are also getting quite popular, which are part electric, part gas driven. And I mean, to be honest, it's absolutely right. You can't really conceive of a future in which we have as many gas-driven vehicles as we do at the moment, that there just isn't going to be resources to do that. And the options on the table are these new technologies that are coming through. So even if you do have to think about managing them slightly differently, these are the places where we're probably looking at our future.
Jerry, I want to thank you for being on the program.
Yes.
Jerry Herbertson is in Petersburg. If you'd hang on the line for a few minutes here, there may be some caller that wants to talk to you about your car there, but I'll give out the website again, and we'll link to it on our website.
Okay, appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Jerry Herbertson. I am zipping back around to economics theory now with our guest, Tim Jackson, who is the author of Prosperity Without Growth, Economics for a Finite Planet. And remember, we're not talking about the real planet. The real planet, you can burn as much energy as you want, and people are going to get more prosperous, and there's going to be competition, and that's going to generate prosperity for everybody. That's the real world. We're talking about a hypothetical world that's not true in. So I don't want to debate that. That's what I'm getting down to. Tim Jackson, does... It's occurring to me. I remember my first fisheries biology conference that I went to. I could not understand anything that they were talking about. I kept nodding off, and they would show these histograms and these, and they talk about recruitment endlessly. And what their entire science, as it turned out, was all about: is there any way that we can get fish big enough to catch quicker and in larger numbers? And that's the entire research was about that. Then it suddenly, right after the Exxon Valdez oil spill occurred, they went back and looked at all the fisheries data that had been picked up, and they discovered something called a regime change. It turned out that in the mid-1970s, and somehow this was not in any of this fisheries research, but there it was when you looked at the records of the trawls that were made every year and what they picked up, that the species composition of particularly the Bering Sea, but also the North Pacific, had changed. It had just changed in a period of a couple of years, become something entirely different. And this was the beginning of fisheries biology encountering chaos theory, or what they're now calling complexity. And it occurs to me that this may be what is happening at this very moment in your science of economics, because I think there are a number of people that might be ready to accept that something is going to become completely different when you have an economy, let's say, that's based on logging and you run out of logs. You know,
absolutely. That's you know, in a nutshell, that's kind of where we are. We're in a place where we're just slowly beginning to realize not only that there are these hard and fast limits, logs, fish, oil, out there that are pretty soon going to come home to roost, but also that we haven't got the understanding that we need, both for seeing ourselves through that. Somehow, but also even for the basic understanding of how our economies work. in those circumstances. And I mean, it's bizarre, really. I mean, your example about the, you know, the fisheries research. Why was that the focus of research? Because there was no understanding of the limits, and because the thing we wanted to do as fast as possible was to catch as much fish as possible. And that, as an analogy for what we're doing in the economy, is a pretty good one, actually. We are, you know, have concentrated for 60 or 70 years, probably more, actually, on how to make as much stuff as possible and to deliver it in markets as possible and to take it out of the ground as fast as possible and build our economic system around it. And indeed, we built that system incredibly well. We built it so cleverly, in fact, that all of our institutions, our banks, our financial institutions, our building societies, our regulatory systems are all built around keeping that machine going as fast as possible. And it's quite salutary, really, to just wake up at that point and think, ah, no, we don't know. We don't know how to make this different kind of economy work. If we stop the logging or the fishing or the oil extraction, if we stop that stuff, our economies crash. And that's a, you know, that's an incredibly challenging place to be, and understanding that the limits are there, but we don't know how to make it work differently. And it's exactly that kind of wake-up call. It's, we need a different kind of economics. We need to be measuring things differently. We need different sets of institutions. We need different targets. And we need the science, the new science of economics that goes with that.
Well, not to pound it into the ground, but here is Ken by email saying, the term sustainable growth is itself an oxymoron. The fact is, there are already way too many people on this planet consuming too many resources. It appears that we are destined to the same fate as a colony of bacteria in a petri dish, to consume all available resources until we die in the poison of our own waste. So, let the party begin, huh? How do you answer?
I think, I mean, it's very easy when you look at those growth curves to be very, very pessimistic. But it's also true, I think, and this is something that's worth reminding ourselves of, that this is quite a recent phenomenon. It's one, you know, that is historical. It's a period of 4 or 5 decades, 6 or 7 maybe, where we've established a pattern of organizing society that has had the wrong assumptions. But actually, the one thing that we do still have left, and in quite optimistic ways, is human ingenuity. We fashioned a system that doesn't work. When we wake up and realize that, we have the potential to fashion a different kind of system.
All right. We're talking with Tim Jackson. He's the author of Prosperity Without Growth, Economics for a Finite Planet. He is a commissioner on economics for the Sustainable Development Commission in the United Kingdom. As he says, well, sometimes they actually do listen to us. And it's Talk of Alaska. We're going to get down into more of the nuts and the bolts of how do we get to the other side of this thing with our next guest in the next half hour. Let's go ahead and try and take a call here. Let's go ahead and go to Roberta in Homer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Roberta.
Good morning. And this is broken record, Roberta, by now, but I've had this simple concept, and this might be the perfect time. I've been wanting to see a template for sustainability and decisions on all projects worldwide. I don't mess around. I just go worldwide.
So in other words, before you go ahead with the project, you basically want to put it through a screen of 4 tests, right? And those are your four E's.
4 tests. And those 4 tests are economy, environment, energy, and ethics. And every one of those would have to be passed before the decision got made to do whatever those projects are. And it's simple, but I do believe it could change the way we do everything. And then my little simpler ones are lower the speed limits to 55 miles an hour, but I like the electric car idea, and we just slow down. That would be wonderful. And turn off all the lights in all the cities, most of them in the nation and the world. And then we go to thinking about what Bioneers was saying on Sunday about environmental justice and green-collar jobs, and get off our pollution and poison economy and turn it over to the green, and we are on our way.
Well, you might be starting to get on our way. Tim Jackson, what do you make of Roberta's take on things?
Actually, I really like the four E's thing. I mean, we've looked at our decisions through a kind of one E lens, the economy lens, for most of the last few decades, and we got things disastrously wrong. And actually, one of the things that sustainable development says is you need that wider lens. You need to question the environment. You need to question, actually, I'd put equity in there. You know, are we actually sharing the goods in society fairly? And certainly, there's an ethical question there. So maybe you've captured that already. But one of the things that sustainable development does is to say exactly that, that you need a different sort of assessment framework when you're making these kinds of decisions under these conditions. And you know, I think that's a really strong outcome. Of course, you still have to persuade policy to take that seriously. They tend to be very persuaded by the 1E number, you know, dollars, and there's some very good reasons for that. One is that dollars, at least in principle, are supposed to provide people with jobs. But as you say, quite rightly, there are jobs. There are jobs in this new economy. There are jobs in the new technologies. These green-collar jobs make more sense than anything else, particularly in the face of the recession that we've seen and the challenges ahead.
Tim Jackson has been our guest. Tim, if you'd stay with us for a little bit of the second half hour, you get a chance to meet Bob Costanzo, who I think you already know.
Sure, I'd love to do that.
All right, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist awards. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation. NOAA Fisheries Service requires sport charter halibut fishing operators to apply between February 4th and April 5th of this year for next year's permit in southeast and south central Alaska. Apply during this period or you won't receive a permit even if you qualify otherwise. Information online at alaskafisheries.noaa.gov or call 1-800-304-4846. Press option number 2. This message sponsored by NOAA Fisheries Service.
Well, over in the United Kingdom, where our guest is, it is actually 7:30 in the evening, so it's getting late for Tim Jackson over there at the University of Surrey. Are you in your office, Tim?
I am. Yes, I'm looking forward to my supper, but very happy to be with you, and happy to stay for a few more minutes.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and we're awaiting a connection with Bob Costanzo here. But let's go ahead and go to one of our callers here from Muldoon. Stu, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thanks, Steve. Hey, I have a question for everybody. Are the Amish happy?
I think...
I can't answer that question because I don't know any Amish.
Well, actually, I do. And I would say, by and large, yes. But it's sometimes very difficult for the younger generation. But I think maybe our next guest might have a little insight on that one, too. And there probably some callers. So that's a great question.
I'm here, if you can hear me.
Bob Costanzo?
Yes, hi.
Robert Costanzo is director of the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics, the Rubenstein School of Environment and Natural Resources, University of Vermont, and publisher of the online magazine Solutions, which is really fascinating. And Bob, I understand that you are one of the founders of this thing called Ecological Economics. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. Herman Daly and I co-founded the Society for Ecological Economics back in 1988, and I was the first editor of the journal Ecological Economics.
And my eyebrow was raised when I saw an article in Science written by you, and you said intelligent design is evolution.
We're actually the other way around.
Evolution is intelligent design, yes. But I mean, you just don't expect that in a scientific publication, and yet there it was. And maybe you can kind of give us a little thumbnail on how you get to that conclusion that there is intelligence in evolution, because we're trained to think of random mutations and selective pressures.
Well, it's the selective pressures part that actually leads to the intelligence of the design. So, you know, and we tend to focus, or at least the discussion often focuses just on the random mutations, but really it is a very strong selection process, and that's essentially what a design process is. You know, we're creating alternatives; those are then tested against how they work in the real world, and the ones that work best reproduce themselves. So there's also been a sort of revival in the scientific literature of the whole idea of multi-level selection or group selection. There was a very interesting paper by Edward Sloan Wilson and David Wilson on that topic, going back into how the sort of biological or evolutionary community, in their view, got off track and got too focused on just trying to explain everything with genetic scale, individual scale evolution, evolutionary processes, when in fact evolution occurs at multiple scales, you know, from the genes to the individual to the, and even individuals are not individuals when you think about it. You know, we're actually complex ecosystems with lots of different organisms operating in synergistic ways. So
basically,
when you start thinking about all those things, you know, evolution does create a sort of intelligence. It is not random in any sense of the word. It's not consciously intelligent in that sense, at least, you know, except for the parts of the system like us that are conscious. But in general, you don't need the consciousness for it to be intelligent.
Yeah, and
intelligent.
And it would appear that you're also talking about as we people basically, they have ideas, they implement these ideas, and a lot of them don't work, and some of them do, and then they tend to be reproduced.
Exactly. And that's the whole idea of cultural evolution. I think that, you know, the real advantage that humans have as a species, and I think one of the main reasons that we've managed to come to dominate the planet, is that we can learn from our and we can pass on our learned behavior. You know, that we can that cultures do evolve, and you know, when we learn how to do things, we can write them down or say them to others, and you know, communicate them, and they spread very quickly. So cultural evolution can be much faster than biological evolution, at least for big slow growing species like us. And you know, look at what we've done with that process. I would say a big fraction of our behavior. Of course, this is often debated, the nature nurture kind of debate. But you know, it's clear that a big fraction of our behavior is determined by our culture and our learned behavior, and not our genetic programming.
We're talking with Robert Costanza. He is the director of the Gund Institute for Ecological Economics in Vermont. And also with us still is Tim Jackson at the University of Surrey. I think you may know Tim, Bob.
Yes. Hi, Tim. How are you doing?
I'm well. Hello, Bob.
Good. Yeah, we just were on a panel together in Washington just a week ago or so.
Really? Well, let me ask you and Tim to both chime in on what you think of the Obama, the way he decided to spin in his budget on converting the economy, where he's talking about, he's chosen the term clean energy, and he said that we can create jobs to build the infrastructure of clean energy. Do you like that? Does that work for you?
That works for me. I think the only problem is this sort of addiction to GDP growth that we seem to still be in.
Yes. Well, we just spent a half an hour on that with Tim. Yeah, Tim.
Right.
I know you. I know you are getting hungry. So let me turn it back on you. What did you make of this push by Obama? This is how he decided to interpret it for the public and to try and steer it in the budget, that they continue stimulus, but they kind of pull some of the tax breaks away from fossil fuels and move over towards more job creation in things that would create an infrastructure toward a more sustainable economy.
Actually, I think it's terrific. For all the allegiance that we still have to the idea of continued growth within that, what the one thing we know that we need is a transformation in the energy and in the energy infrastructures, and in particular in relation to the carbon implications of that and the resource implications of that. Steaming ahead with an economy that doesn't understand the need for clean energy is just a recipe for disaster, really, and hitting the buffers in a matter of decades, less than decades, rather than centuries. So to have an administration with a very serious commitment to that is enormous opportunity, really. We just haven't had that in the past, and I think it's a terrific opportunity for transformation.
Well, thank you very much for being with us, Tim Jackson.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Hi, Tim. Yeah. Bob, are you a heretic in your own field? I mean, essentially, Tim Jackson and of course this fellow that you work with, this Herman Daly, he was definitely thought to be a heretic, and Tim's kind of going against the grain in the economics belief system, I guess we could call it. Where do you come down? What field do you come out of? You come out of, it seems like, a sort of this ecology angle.
Yeah, my PhD was in systems ecology, and actually took economics as a foreign language as part of that. Instead of Spanish, I took economics. So, but I think throughout grad school, and I was lucky enough to be associated with an advisor who was, you know, a real systems thinker. So it was always trying to look at the connections between the pieces and not isolate, you know, economics as a discipline or ecology as a discipline, because, you know, the real world doesn't really adhere to those boundaries. And as we're seeing, many of the problems that we're facing now are really transcending those disciplinary boundaries. So I've always thought of myself as a more transdisciplinary scientist rather than fitting into one or another box. And of course, that makes some friends and some enemies, but you know, I'm not, and in ecological economics in general, we're not trying to be necessarily an alternative to economics or ecology, but really sort of to try to build bridges, take the best of both, try to build a more integrated understanding of how the world works. And certainly some parts of conventional economic theory are useful and some maybe need to be revised, expanded, likewise for all the other disciplines. And it's not just ecology and economics either. It's also psychology and geology and climatology and history, and, you know, we're really trying to build a more integrated understanding of how the world functions and how it has functioned historically. One project I'm working with is something called IHOPE, the Integrated History and Future of People on Earth. So the idea there is to integrate our environmental history and our human history and really look in depth at how humans have interacted with the environment and the climate over time, what really has led to the success or collapse of historical societies, and what can we really learn from that, from those observations? Can we really understand the full sweep of human, you know, presence in the biosphere and use that to help us create a better future? You know, we're not trying to predict the future, but it's been said that the best way to predict the future is to create it.
Well, you know, I'm getting this feeling that I'm going to get a barrage of criticism saying all you're doing is legitimizing the anti-growthers. Everybody knows anti-growth doesn't work. Just look at limits to growth. And so I guess I'll throw it to you, Bob Costanza. Are you an anti-growther?
Well, it's interesting that you brought up limits to growth, because actually one of the papers we have in an upcoming issue of Solutions is about the sort of history of that whole limits to growth debate. And if you go back to the original book, they were not predicting a peak even under business as usual scenario, their business as usual scenario in economic output until just about now, maybe a little bit further into the future. And that their point was not was more how do we create. They were focused much more on how we create a sustainable and desirable future, and recognizing that in some cases, you know, additional growth doesn't really benefit the people in the system. It's like any organism. You know, I certainly personally don't want to keep growing in physical terms. You know. We want to grow to the point where it's, or grow to an optimal level, and then start working on quality and development. And so there are, you know, it's this distinction, I think, between growth and development, or between quantity and quality, that we need to start really taking seriously, as Tim Jackson probably pointed out to you. You know, conventional economic consumption production is a means to an end, but it's not an end in itself. And if we confuse the means and the end, you can really do yourself damage. And I think that's where we are now, but we need to make that shift. And I think there are those who are you know, aware of this issue. President Sarkozy in France, for example, commissioned Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize winner in economics, and Amartya Sen recently, to look at the, you know, the problems with GDP as a measure of well-being. And I think it's well known among economists that GDP was never intended as a measure of economic well-being. It only measures economic activity, production, and consumption. And it doesn't really distinguish well between things that are negative and things that are positive. You know, more crime leads to higher GDP. So, you know, we've got to take that seriously and start measuring the things that we really want rather than just the things that we have historically measured.
You and your colleagues last February, about a year ago, put out a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, Overcoming Systemic Roadblocks to Sustainability, the Evolutionary Redesign of Worldviews, Institutions, and Technology, which is a great title.
And you go
leaping right into it, right at the beginning, laying out Easter Island and all these other collapsed societies, and saying what happened, in essence, was that they became brittle.
Yes.
And that is interesting. Do you think we're kind of brittle here in our Western civilization?
Well, I think we are. I think that's the real question. Can we change our worldviews and the institutions and the technologies that are all tightly interconnected with those worldviews? And that was part of the point of the paper, is that, you know, we have to change the whole regime, if you will, because of the degree of interconnection of those parts of the system. And that historically, societies that were able to do that, you know, got through the bottlenecks that they were facing. And I think that's exactly what we need to do now. And part of that has to do with overcoming our what I think of as an addiction to this, you know, growth at all costs model. It's not that growth is bad. I think the real issue is, when is growth positive? When is it useful? And when is it become the wrong thing to do to continue with growth? And so, obviously, there are some countries in the world that still need conventional growth of material consumption. And there are others that probably don't need continued growth, and that by some measures have actually have already peaked. So there are things like the Genuine Progress Indicator, which tries to improve on GDP and make a better approximation of real quality of life. It does that by incorporating estimates of income distribution, because we know that if you're talking about welfare instead of just income, a dollar's worth of income to a rich person doesn't produce as much additional welfare as a dollar's worth of income to a poor person. It's kind of decreasing returns. So you've got to worry about income distribution if you're really talking about welfare. You've got to worry about losses of social capital. And this gets back to your original comment about the Amish. The Amish have very good social capital, and that contributes heavily. We know now from many psychological studies, it contributes very heavily to people's sense of well-being. Their connection with their community and their family and their friends, etc., you know, is often much more important than how much stuff they have. And also our natural capital assets, or the ecosystem services that are provided by natural ecosystems that support our well-being and are worth, you know, by our estimates, even more than our conventional GDP.
You know, it strikes me in the climate change debate, Bob Costanza, there was this dichotomy that this battle between whether we should be mitigating or adapting. And it sounds to me that actually mitigating would have to be part of adapting, from the way you're looking at it. In other words, in order to become flexible and adaptable, we really need to become more maneuverable.
For sure. And I think, you know, both of those are obviously going to be parts of the parts of the strategy. It's clear that we're going to have a hard time mitigating all of the potential climate change impacts, and even to do that mitigation, we have to adapt culturally. So, you know, they are intimately interconnected.
Thank you.
Adaptation and mitigation. But just to finish the point with the GPI, you know, that measure has been applied in several different countries. In the U.S., it shows that since 1975, our genuine progress has really not been improving at all. It's been relatively flat, even though GDP has more than doubled. So the question in the growth debate really is, what is it that you want to grow? Do you want simply, you know, do you want bad things to grow? As we said, you know, more crime, more oil pollution, more problems of several kinds, higher healthcare costs. Those all add to GDP, but they don't add to well-being. And you could argue that the U.S. economy hasn't really been growing in quality terms since 1975.
So, oh my heavens!
What we need. That's what we need to change. And I think people's perception of their own well-being, and there have been surveys of quality of life and happiness over time that show the same statistics, that people's sense of well-being overall hasn't really improved since the 70s. So what is it that we're really doing? You know, what's this all this economic activity for? And if it's not for making us better off, which is what it really should be for, we had better start measuring what really does make us better off. How much better off are we? And we're, I think, measuring just the wrong things right now. And pursuing those wrong things is I think, a form of addiction that we really need to confront.
Robert Costanza is our guest. He is a proponent of ecological economics as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Rasmussen Foundation announces a March 1st deadline to apply for individual artist awards, which provide funding directly to artists to support their creative work. Sign up to participate in one of our information sessions to be held the week of January 25th by calling 297-2827 or visit rasmussen.org for more information. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Well, Bob Costanza, as you know, this is a call-in show, and we've had a thunder of calls, but your points have been so interesting that I really have wanted to draw you out and get you to get all your points across. But I would like to get some calls in. We get an email from Brad Brooks who said, well, this change in economy makes me think of my current economic situation and planning for my retirement. And change takes planning. Ole Olson from Tok, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. Should I go ahead?
You can go ahead, Ole.
Yes, I was happy to hear your caller mention the Amish. I'm an advocate of a micro solution rather than a macro solution to our economic problems. And I look at the Amish as a sustained growth community in Lancaster County. One statistic that impressed me on public radio a couple of months ago, they interviewed a banker from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, who had said that in 20 years, there had never been a farm mortgage foreclosure in Lancaster County that he was aware of.
Mm. Yeah, you know, of course, they had to mess around with the tax laws and so forth in order to make this work. I mean, it was a long fight, and even now, there are problems in terms of land ownership because you have so many heirs, and you have to figure out how to keep a sustainable size farm going. So there's a growth problem with Amish. Where I come from in the northern part of Pennsylvania, a lot of Amish moving in up there because they're reproducing and they got more kids and they can't all have farms.
Well, this speaks to my second point.
Yes.
Land is the main source of wealth for a country, and another example would be in 1919, American agriculture was most productive of any year, which is also the parity year. There was no nitrogen fertilizer. There were no tractors. 70% of the people lived on the land. Now, when you look at transportation, for example, the interstate highway system, which I worked on in the 60s, has allowed people to move away from their place of work to the point where the agricultural land has been gobbled up by suburbs. When you fly into Minneapolis, your descent for half an hour is over suburban homes, which were productive agriculture. And you look at the Mayan model here, I think your second guest would agree that when you fill up the agricultural land with housing, it's not a very good formula for growth.
Bob Costanza, he's probably preaching to the choir here, isn't he?
Yes, I think so. And what we've done in conventional agriculture is try to maximize the output per worker, and that involves using more machines, more fossil fuels on the land. But the output per hectare has actually gone down. So we can actually produce more food per hectare, I think, doing agriculture in a different way, in a more diverse, more, including more permaculture. And I think our the future of agriculture, I think, will be a movement sort of away from the highly intensive, energy intensive and machine intensive, back to a more organic, labor-intensive kind of agriculture, and I think that can be more successful in a number of different ways, including having better, stronger farm communities. Farm communities are basically dissipated because there's one farmer can farm thousands of acres these days. I think when we did a project in Iowa recently, a short course on the future of food and agriculture, and interviewed a whole range of different farmers from organic to conventional. And the consensus was that was a real cut. That was a real loss of quality of life, the loss of those farm communities. And, operating as individual industrial farmers, just basically taking care of their machines is not really improve the quality of life for those farmers, even though it's improved the output per worker and allowed more people to leave the farms.
Well, with only 1 minute left here, I hate to say it, but I mean, Ole, you're not saying we should turn back the clock, are you?
Well, I am saying that the top-down agricultural practices of the Department of Agriculture have been part of the problem. Factory floor farming, and you talked about the interconnectedness of these large banks and corporations. Well, Cargill, Archer Daniels, Midland, and those type of outfits hold most of the land in the Midwest. That's why two men are farming three sections.
We're out of time.
They were 160-acre farms.
Got it. We're out of time. Bob Costanza, I want to thank you so much.
You.
It was absolutely fascinating. Talk of
Thanks
Alaska.
A lot.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Thanks also to Len Anderson and Laurie Townsend for the phones today, and Dave Waldron on the controls. I'm Steve Eimel. Thank you for listening and calling. Bye.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.